Okay.
Yeah. She came to me and I said, no, because I raised the rate for the church. She said, no, that's some private church. It's just maybe you can get some lights.
Call the House Judiciary Committee to order April 7th, 2011. Staff, what's the first bill we have? I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2692.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. House Bill 2692 comes to us from the sheriffs and pertains to writs of garnishment, the rules that would regulate those. It makes a number of modifications. I'll just list the most significant, I believe. I've tried to catch all of them in my staff measure summary. First of all, it clarifies that identification documents, social security cards, passports, and the like, are not property that are fairly subject to garnishment. Similarly, if a sheriff obtains the contents of a financial safe deposit box, which is in the garnishee's possession or control, and discovers documents of that kind, the sheriff may seize them, but they may not be sold or liquidated as part of satisfying the debt which gave rise to the garnishment. This also clarifies some rules about who is responsible for damages for property which is to be sold pursuant to a garnishment. If the sheriff does not take possession of the property, it clarifies that the sheriff will not be responsible for those damages. It also requires that a writ of execution pursuant to a garnishment clarify the rate of interest to be paid and how much interest has already been accrued.
Okay, can we have, is it Kreshi Meister, Meister? And then Brian Wallace. Please state your name and either one of you can start first.
Co-Chair Barkers and Krieger and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brian Wallace. I'm the Chief Civil Supervisor at the Marion County Sheriff's Office and President of the Oregon Sheriff's Civil Command Council. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2692, and I thank you all for this opportunity. Written testimony has been submitted to be a part of the official record by myself and my colleague. I'd like to run through all of the sections of this bill fairly quickly, as a majority of the proposed changes are real technical in nature, although legislative counsel has summarized them eloquently. In section one, our contention is that because of the Real ID Act federal law, we can't disclose driver's license numbers or any sort of identification. So why on earth would the sheriff sell those at a auction? And oftentimes when we go to seize property pursuant to a writ of execution or a garnishment, such as items found in a safety deposit box, it's kind of like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get. Sometimes we get things of value, sometimes we don't. Oftentimes people will put or place their social security card, their passport, things of those nature in their safety deposit box. And as the law really kind of stands right now, we're obligated to sell those because we're ministerial. We don't get to pick and choose what we seize and what we give back to a debtor. So that's all that we're trying to accomplish really there. And again, that would align with federal, the Real ID Act. Jumping ahead to Section 3 of the bill, our intention there is at times we're asked to levy on property under a garnishment. So in other words, somebody's holding property of someone else. So it's acquired through what's called a writ of garnishment. So a lot of times the sheriff will garnish that property and be instructed to sell it at auction. A lot of times that property could very well just remain in the possession of the garnishee or the one that's holding the property in the first place. An example would be, it could be horses that are being garnished at a boarding facility. Why not just keep it with the people that know how to take care of them? We don't want to assume any liability if something goes awry in that case. So we just kind of want to be abstained from any sort of liability if the garnishee agrees to hold on to that property for us. And horses is just an example. There's been cases where we've had tons of grass seed in Linn County is another example. So we just don't want to be liable if anything happens to that. Section 5 of the bill, again, that has to do with the identification documents. We talked about that, safety deposit box. Section 6 of this bill, we would like to add that on a writ of execution, the writ must state or include the interest as of the date that the request for issuance of the writ by the court administrator is included, and it also must state the amount of interest accruing on that money award each day. And that ties into a later section in our bill when we're saying what we would like is the ability for a debtor to be able to pay off their judgment or debt before the sheriff auctions off their property. So in order for the sheriff to be able to do that, we need to know precisely what is owed on that money award and what the interest is every day so that we can make that calculation. So that's what that does right there. Section 8 of this bill deletes a clause which is, before bidding at a sale, a prospective bidder should independently investigate, and then it lists on page 5 a variety of different things. We want to delete that and just move it into the sheriff's notice of sale requirement. Right now, a creditor is required to put that in the instructions to the sheriff. We already put it in our form automatically. Our Oregon State Sheriff's Association has a civil manual, and that language is already included in all of our forms. So we're just trying to put it in a place that makes sense. Section 13, jumping ahead, that's the legal notices website. Last session, we met with the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association, and they had no issues with what we were trying to do, which was to create one website in the state by the sheriffs in order to do internet postings for sales of property. Well, what we found was that during last session, we put that it can be established if all the sheriffs in the state enter into an IGA or an intergovernmental agreement. And what we found is that proves rather difficult to get all 36 sheriffs of the state simultaneously to agree on that, especially if sheriffs are constantly being elected and coming in and out of office for various reasons, so, and retirement and all that. So we wanted to change that to just a majority of elected sheriffs. That's just a technical change so that we can get moving on that website. Okay, that's a good sign. Nobody's falling asleep yet. So, Section 14. Again, that ties in with what we were trying to do with the putting the interest that accrues each day in the writ and the amount owed, because under Section 14, sub 7, at any time before we conduct a sale, we want the judgment debtor or the defendant to have the ability to pay off said judgment in order to get their property back. A lot of times we're instructed to go seize, let's just say, for instance, a 2010 BMW, and the judgment is $5,000. maybe the car's worth $20,000. Well, it would seem to me that it would be fair for the debtor to be able to pay that $5,000 off right away and not lose their 2010 BMW. Section 16, you notice that we're changing in sub 1 there, line 41 on page 7, we're changing the word A to the judgment creditor who requested issuance of a writ may make oral bids. The reason that we're changing it from A to the is because in one particular county, a judgment creditor who had a judgment that was totally unrelated to the action that was being taken by the Multnomah County Sheriff showed up and said, well, I'm a judgment creditor, so I should be able to credit bid my judgment, which is totally unrelated and over here. I believe it got taken to court, and I'm not sure. I don't want to misspeak, but really the whole basis behind that is that it should be the judgment creditor that has that particular judgment that can make bids against their own judgment. So that's what the intent was many moons ago. That's what we've always done. So, and that's just the most fair to the debtor, the judgment creditor in that particular case as well. And that is all that I have. I would be happy to answer any questions that you may have at this time.
Why don't you go ahead and testify?
Co-chairs and members of the committee, my name is Christy Meister. I'm with the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office, and I'm here today to testify on behalf of 2692 for the Oregon State Sheriff's Association and the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office. The only thing I would have to add on this as to what Brian said is just a little bit more clarification on the sheriff's website change that we're asking for. In the language that was there, the court initially had the language, and we adopted some of that and made some changes when we asked for the sheriff to take it because the court hadn't done anything with it. It requires all the sheriffs to not only agree to start it, but to maintain it. And it's really the maintenance part of it that prevents us from even getting started, because once we invest or there's money invested in that, nobody is going to want to continue it if it keeps going up and down based on an agreement of the sheriffs. We'd probably be able to get the agreement to get it going, but the maintenance is sheriffs come and go is what we're worried about. So that's the only thing that I would really add to what Brian said about.
Representative Shoffer, you have a question?
If she's finished, are you finished?
Are you finished?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Coming in and asking that we not allow sheriffs to garnish these documents, driver's license, passport, birth certificate, or Social Security, implies that someone is, and then not allowing them to sell them. Is this actually happening? Are they taking these documents and selling them? I can't imagine that anybody out there is doing that.
I'll go ahead and address that, Representative Schaefer. We have had situations where we have seized documents such as that. What we've been able to manage to do so far is to be able to work with the plaintiff in the case to ask for release of those documents. At least in our office, it's been successful, but it's not an uncommon thing when we do find something in a safety deposit box to find some type of identification documents. So this would just clarify the law.
Ms. Chair.
Follow-up.
Thank you, but that's not what I asked.
Is
anybody selling these documents? I can't imagine anybody's out there selling these. I think there's already probably some law against that. It's personal information.
Co-chairs and Representative Shoffler, let me address your concern there. The sheriff is ministerial in his or her duties when it comes to civil process, meaning that we do what we're told. The way that the statute's constructed right now, when we're instructed to go and drill a safety deposit box, we're required to seize the contents, the entire contents. In my county, personally, I've had conversations with my legal counsel, and we're comfortable in refusing to sell those documents, but there are some counties that are advised by their legal counsel that they don't have a choice. So we want it crystal clear by the legislature that we're not to do this. Because what Christy was saying, oftentimes we'll send a list of what we've seized in that in the box to the creditor and say, okay, this is what we have, and they can instruct us via, you know, a letter, signed letter, saying, we don't want you to sell, you know, this costume jewelry or, you know, a passport, obviously, because there's no real value in that at all. There are some creditors that do not respond to the sheriff, and for whatever reason, and we can't control that. So I know it doesn't seem right, and it doesn't make sense, and whatnot, but
Sheriff,
that's where we're at.
The words make sense. If we have to make a statute directing people to do every single thing that would any normal, sensible person would do, we would never be done. It just doesn't make a lick of sense to think that any sheriff... I can understand garnishing and taking possession of property of value, but just because it doesn't say don't sell their passport or their driver's license, I give the sheriffs enough credit to know that they just wouldn't go do that. But I'm willing to vote for the bill if the chairs decide to move it. But it just, this is the funniest one I've seen so far, Mr.
I think
Chair.
We got a carrier.
Any further questions?
Yeah, Mr. Kocher. Just real quickly, I missed your citation on the section talking about the judgment debtor being able to pay off the debt before the items are sold. And the reason for my question is I want to make sure if they do that, that the costs of sale are still covered.
Co-chairs and Representative Wan, that is correct. All of those fees that creditors have paid so far in order for the sheriff to execute that writ, whether it's towing and storage or movers, whatever, they're still entitled to that, and the sheriff would calculate that and include that in the payoff amount.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Co-chair.
Anything further? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll close the public hearing on 2692 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2693.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, House Bill 2693 again pertains to the sheriff, specifically this time when the sheriffs are asked to serve warrants for various departments, including the Department of Transportation, Department of Revenue, or to the Director of the Employment Department. Presently, if a person has a delinquent debt to one of those agencies, the agencies may issue a warrant, and it commands the sheriff to levy and sell real and personal property. Under current law, the sheriff is obligated upon receipt of that warrant to record within 5 days with the clerk of the county. House Bill 2693 would remove that obligation as to the sheriff and place it on the department. The department issuing the warrant would become responsible for entering the warrant with the county clerk. Other change proposed by 2693 would add to the, I think, 28 or so existing hearsay exceptions within the Oregon Evidence Code, a new subsection for the current hearsay exception for records, reports, statements, or data compilations made by public offices or agencies, making explicit that evidence of a sheriff's return of service in a civil or criminal proceeding would be admissible at trial.
Co-Chair Barker and Co-Chair Krieger and members of the committee, my name is Christy Meister with the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office. I'm here today to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 2690, or House Bill, I'm sorry, 2693 for the Oregon State Sheriff's Association and Lincoln County Sheriff's Office. Our intent with this bill, the majority of this bill, was to get out of the business of being a middleman, as we say, that's how the sheriffs refer to it, for distraint warrants. And the majority distraint warrants that are filed, we're talking about the Transportation Department, the Employment Department, Department of Revenue are our main ones. The majority of them never have any enforcement action taken against them. And so they're simply sent to the sheriff's office for basically logging them in, and then we go deliver them to the clerk's office for recording. The clerk sends them back to us. We get the book and page number and make a return back to those departments. And for that, we get $6.25. And we've, you know, this is something I'm sure started many, many years ago, and it's never been changed. But What we're asking for is the for the warrants to be sent directly to the county clerk by those departments, and that would save the state the fee of $6.25 that they're paying to the sheriff, and it certainly doesn't pay our costs just to handle that paperwork. What this does is it also maintains the method for those departments to be able to direct the sheriff to execute on those warrants when they need to go collect on them. And so that's maintained in the statute. Now, along with that section, my written testimony says that we've worked with the Department of Revenue. They have House Bill 3261, and it impacts the same statutes that we have in our bill is in theirs. And so we worked together, and as of yesterday, we had come to an agreement on some amendments that we were going to be putting forth. As I was entering the building here today, I met with the Department of Revenue, and we will be working next week with the Legislative Council to really come up with the actual wording that is going to satisfy them. We've agreed on what we both need, and then we're going to have those identical in each of those House bills and present amendments. When I am talking about amendments, I am also going to be attempting to work with the Department of Transportation, who I haven't heard back from, and I've already discussed the amendments with the Employment Division because the language needs to be similar throughout, and I did have agreement with them. This bill also provides for a sheriff's return, that a sheriff's return is not hearsay for the purpose of Oregon Evidence Code. It maintains the right of the defense to subpoena the serving deputy. What's happened here is we have a few district attorney's offices across the state that are basically requiring an appearance by every deputy on a restraining order when a restraining order is when a restraining order violation has occurred, and they're automatically calling the serving deputy in for testimony that is their return. The majority of the district attorneys are not doing that. In Lincoln County, we don't have that problem. But what we would like is some clarification in there that the return of service is not hearsay for the purpose of that, and just adding the service of those restraining orders to that section.
Co-chairs Barker and Krieger, and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brian Wallace, Chief Civil Supervisor of the Marion County Sheriff's Office and President of the Oregon Sheriff's Civil Command Council. I'm here to testify in support of this bill, House Bill 2693. And just to kind of add to what my colleague is saying with the distraint warrants, I know that Co-Chair Barker, and I believe there might be a couple others, I can't remember from a couple or from last session, but this was that bill that we tried to eliminate that $6.25 for us to go file something with the county clerk. And at that time, we told the legislature that we did a rough calculation of how much the total amount is with all 36 counties that were generating in revenue by state agencies, and it turned out to be roughly $100,000 for a year for us to take a piece of paper, file it with the county clerk. So now, since we have this concept, we're up to $200,000 a year, and in this tough economic time, that's money that I'm sure everybody, the state agencies themselves, would love to have. So I just wanted to add that, since that's definitely one or two positions with the state, if you break it down that way. As far as the hearsay exception goes, as my colleague was saying, there are some district attorneys that require physical appearance in court by the serving deputy. And a lot of times, well, majority of the time, and I know that there's some former law enforcement in this committee, you don't get an opportunity to dictate when that court date's going to be. So oftentimes you're subpoenaed on your day off. And it's an overtime situation, so this is really a fiscal impact to law enforcement agencies having to pay overtime or court time for a deputy to come in and literally say, yeah, I did in fact serve that restraining order for the contempt proceedings. So this just makes it crystal clear, and that's all that I had to add, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Committee members? Okay, thank you. We'll close a public hearing on House Bill 2693 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2694.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, House Bill 2694 again comes to us from the sheriff's. This proposal pertains to writs of eviction and nuisance abatement orders. It would fundamentally do two things. First of all, presently, a sheriff with a writ of eviction has 30 days to enforce that writ following its issuance, and then it automatically expires and becomes unenforceable. House Bill 2694 would allow this to be extended upon a showing of good cause made to the court by the sheriff. Secondly, this bill would modify who bears the cost of the execution of an order to abate a nuisance as executed, by the sheriff. Currently, the sheriff is required to abate the nuisance at the expense of the defendant and then subsequently levy the expenses on the defendant's property in the form of an execution against that property. This bill would permit the sheriff to require that a plaintiff pay all sheriff's fees prior to executing the warrant, and would then allow for the recovery of those fees to be part of any damages that the plaintiff returned.
Okay. Do I still need to state my name and everything for this?
Okay. We're on a new bill.
All right.
We'd like to hear it anyway.
Okay. Co-chairs Barker and Krieger and members of the committee, for the record, I'm still Brian Wallace. And I'm still the Chief Civil Supervisor at the Marion County Sheriff's Office and President of the Oregon Sheriff's Civil Command Council, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2694. And again, I thank you all for entertaining us and listening to us. This is pretty dry stuff, so I know it is. So we really appreciate your time.
We're glued.
What's that?
We're just glued to you.
Oh, yeah.
I'm trying to make sure that selling them passports pretty exciting.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. It's invigorating for us, too. So, this bill, we had a couple of different groups in the last few days give us a call, and I'm going to go through each section, and hopefully it won't take too long, and I'm hopefully going to address Oregon Law Commission and the Metro Multifamily Housing raised a few concerns. So I'm going to hopefully, through our testimony, give you what our intent is, get it on the record, and hopefully there won't be any issues. So I'll do my best. In Section 1 of the bill, page 1, on line 22 through 24, right now the sheriff has 30 days once a writ for an eviction. We're just talking about eviction writs. We have 30 days to execute or enforce that writ from when it's issued. And very, very infrequently, the sheriff will receive a writ at the 11th hour. For whatever reason, a landlord will get the writ, and maybe they're hoping that their tenant will pay or whatever. For whatever reason, they hold on to that writ. And they come into our office 15 days after it's issued, or 20 days. It's just a good example. And normally it takes that day to a couple days for the sheriff to enforce that eviction writ. Once we receive it, we go right out. We remove all defendants that are subject to the judgment, move them out of the house, and we're done. As you know, there's a lot of people with a variety of different issues in this world. One, we have a bit of a mental health crisis in this state. There's one particular county that came up with this concept because in his county alone, they're faced with quite a few tenants that have serious mental health issues. And our goal as the sheriff's office is to get a peaceful removal of these tenants, defendants. Another example, and that's why for good cause, that's where the good cause comes into play. If we need to buy a little bit of time in order to get that, in order to contact you know, mental health or, you know, the VA or any number of other agencies. We want to get all the stakeholders together and come up with a plan before we kick in a door with the SWAT team. That's not what we want to do. The other part of that is people with disabilities or seniors that absolutely have nowhere to go, and we're going to have to work with senior and disabled services or adult protective services. And sometimes, like I was saying, when we get these writs at the 11th hour, we want just a little bit of extra time to get all of those stakeholders together. By no means is this intent for what we want for the sheriff to drag their feet. Like I said, 98-99% of the time when we get these writs, we log them in and we go do them. We don't mess around. So that is certainly all that we're intending. And I realize that good cause by the sheriff might seem a little bit broad, but really there is no way to word, in our opinion, all the different scenarios that we run into, with whether it's people in a mental health crisis or folks that just simply have nowhere to go and they're 80 years old, and believe it or not, that happens. So hopefully that clarifies what our intent is. Obviously, it would be up to the court who reviews the sheriff's motion to determine how much extra time we should have in order to do that. So I know that there really isn't a time frame in there, but I think it just is dependent upon the circumstances. So a court would obviously decide that. And the other concern that some of the stakeholders had was that there's no notification listed in this section of our bill. And I would just say that obviously we're going to be working with the plaintiff and letting them know that, you know, there's a serious situation, so they're going to be notified. But the sheriffs, when we get to the point of an eviction writ, we don't make any further notification to the tenant that we're about ready to physically remove them. That is an extremely dangerous situation for sheriffs. It's an officer safety issue. They've already had their due process. They've gone through the FED summons and complaint part where they had the opportunity to show up to court. Then after judgment is issued against the landlord, they have an additional 4 days and another notice document that they receive. So the due process part is there, and certainly we wouldn't want to notify them that we believe that you have a mental health issue and we're working with all these other agencies in order to see how we can remove you from the residence. That would just be awful to do that. So I just wanted to clarify that. Moving along to the nuisance abatement part, I think Legislative Council explain that rather well as well. I want to make clear that Section 2 and the remainder of the bill has absolutely really nothing to do with the eviction writ part of, in Section 1. The reason that they're in the same bill, obviously, is because they relate to sheriffs and our duties, and they're both found under Chapter 105 of ORS. The way that it's constructed right now is that if a person files a complaint with a court, maybe they think that their neighbor or someone in the neighborhood has a property that is an absolute nuisance, they, and perhaps the city or the county, they don't have code enforcement or ordinances that can address that specific issue. A good example would be like a drug house, a alleged drug house. They can take that person to court, and a court can decide whether or not that property is in fact a nuisance. Well, the way that it's written right now, that person can bring that nuisance abatement warrant to the sheriff, and the sheriff gets to go abate it, meaning we get to go clean up the property, we get to make it pretty again. And let me tell you, there's some properties that aren't so pretty and have environmental issues and have just, they're just a mess, and it would cost thousands upon thousands of dollars potentially for the sheriff and private citizens to clean that property up. What we're wanting to do is just like any other writ of execution that's delivered to the sheriff to levy and seize and sell property, hopefully not passports, but property to satisfy the debt, we're just wanting those costs to be given to the sheriff up front. And then what we did was, in the other sections, we turned around and said that the plaintiff that initiates that suit or the prevailing party has the ability to recover all of those costs and to proceed without a supplemental judgment in any other manner, whether it's a garnishment on wages, whether it's seizing property. And the way that the statute is also constructed, it also says that the sheriff goes and abates it, and in order for the sheriff to kind of recoup his or her fees, we just get to willy-nilly pick property out there of the defendant and then sell it. And the sheriff, as I mentioned before in my previous or prior testimony, we're ministerial. We don't just go and willy-nilly pick property. That's just a big no-no. That's a constitutional issue and something that we're just not in the business of doing. So we want to be instructed by a court or creditor on specifically what to get. So that's the only intent behind that bill. Everything stays in place. People's ability to go forth with their court proceeding. Again, it's a very infrequent thing, but there's a potential for that to cost a lot of money to the sheriff, county, and the general public who have to flip that bill and or foot that bill. And that's our only intent, really. And I'm going to turn it over to my colleague if she has anything to add to that. And I thank you for your time.
Okay. Co-Chair Barker and Co-Chair Krieger and members of the committee, my name is Christy Meister with Lincoln County Sheriff's Office. I'm here today to testify on behalf of House Bill 2694. For the Oregon State Sheriff's Association and the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office. I agree with all the statements that my partner here has made. I do want to add relative to the eviction timeline, the section, I had a conversation with a shareholder at the Oregon Law Center, and one of the current concerns that she had initially had was the defendant's right to overturn a default judgment when something's issued by default. And so she was concerned about the lack of notice when an execution would be extended to a tenant. And I had explained, like my partner had mentioned, that there is no notice now on an execution when it's issued to the tenant. And I let her know that after the hearing on a summons, a notice of restitution is required, which basically gets served on the tenant. And it lets them know that a judgment was entered against them, and it gives them the fine date to be out or that they would be forcibly removed if they weren't. So that's their notice, and at least through my conversation with her, she seemed satisfied by that. She was going to take it back to her group and have more discussion if necessary. Relating to the abatement issue that we're talking about, I just want to mention that every other order that the sheriff gets to go enforce for property seizures, all that kind of stuff, or writs of execution that we get, every one of them comes with a fee to the sheriff, and it has to be paid ahead of time. So we really don't want to end up in a position of being a debt collector and fronting this money up front. And I believe that the statute, if I recall, it only allows for the sheriff to collect out of people's personal property and sell it to collect what they expended. And, you know, in most of these cases, we would never, ever get that money back, and it could be a lot of money is invested in those abatements. So that's the only thing I have to add to that.
Brian, in the last couple of years we've had this economy that we've had, have you seen any increase in these type of evictions that you've been involved in, the sheriffs are being involved in?
Co-Chair Krieger, I can speak for my own county, and well, I believe most others, we have seen quite an increase in residential evictions and some commercial too. I did a scan of how many, and I can't give you a percentage, but I know that it's gone up a lot. The eviction process that we did several years ago compared to now, it definitely has gone up. I don't have firm numbers, but yes.
In your experience, I mean, you've got to have gone to a home where there's kids and a woman there with her children, probably no guy. What do you do? Where do they go? What are you seeing happen to them? Are you able to get services to them ahead of time?
Co-Chair Krieger and members of the committee, you know, I'm trying to be careful because I don't want to seem heartless, but, you know, they go. They got to go. And if they don't have the resources and they have small children and they need help, obviously deputy sheriffs are going to try to do the best that we can to put them in touch with some sort of nonprofit organization, some sort of shelter or church organization that could help them out, absolutely. But a majority of the time, that's just simply not the case. We go out there, the people aren't inside anyway, so we just change the locks and stand by. Sometimes we do go out where it's elderly people that they really don't have any family around, and it's extremely heart-wrenching and sad, and so we try to work real closely with senior and disabled services or adult protective services. But in some of these counties, like Multnomah in particular, my colleague up there has just so many evictions that they do, and there's a lot of people up there with mental health issues, and so he runs across this quite a bit, where they need just some extra time. It's not every day, it's not every month, but there are those circumstances where it would be best if everybody just kind of came together to make a safety plan. But the short answer, yes, we've seen an increase. What do? We do the best that we can. Majority of the time, they're not there, and we just go on our way. Or we remove them because they have a place to go. They have family in the area. They have a friend that they can go stay with. So,
it's not the part of the job that you're going to enjoy much, is it?
Not at all.
Yeah. Committee, you got any other questions, comments? Representative Wisdom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 1, line 23, where you talked about the good cause by the sheriff that you didn't execute the order within 30 days. The owner of the property, he can extend the operation of the WIT by showing good cause by the sheriff, but that's going to cost money. Does that come into effect when you're, you know, charging the person to execute the force and execute the eviction?
Co-chairs, Representative Wisnant, that's a good question. No, this would come solely from the sheriff. We're not going to tack on legal fees that we incur in order to file some sort of motion.
Mr. Chair, follow-up?
Follow-up.
And I'm assuming there's not many cases that's been enforced.
That is correct. This is so infrequent.
That's not a good term for, you know, good cause or something, but I'm assuming we, you know, would use that Manning or emergencies or something like that. Mr. Chair, another question I can put in two form, or one question, I guess, to subjects. I'm not familiar with, there's two terms used, sheriff's fees required by ORS 21410, and then the execute warrant under ORS 105-510. So those are different fees, and you've described to us about different circumstances where you got to clean up the lot and have to clean up the apartment, things like that. So those rates are predetermined by rule, and or what are we talking about as far as the sheriff's fee and the 105.510?
Co-chairs and Representative Wisnant, I'll try to answer that as best as I can. Under ORS 21410, that covers all sheriff's fees that we're entitled to receive for service of process and execution of orders and other papers delivered to the sheriff. It also includes standby time, the cost of standing by, and you know, the time it takes to execute that order. What we're trying to do is say that under 105 for the nuisance abatement is that amounts that are paid to the sheriff in order to do that, which we are entitled to, our fees under 21410, would be recoverable. So we would require a deposit under 21410, which is what we're trying to do here, is to get us to be able to get our fees up front, and it's going to include standby time. It's going to include monies to actually hire a tow truck. Maybe it's a bunch of vehicles on a property, junk vehicles in the backyard, to remove all of that. So that's what our intent is. Does that answer your question, then?
I think so. One last question, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
One last question. Could you give us you're a landowner and, you know, really tried, you want to, but you do have to evict the people. Can you give me a ballpark figure of what the cost to the owner of the facility is going to be? What's the what's the least amount I'm paying to have to evict someone who's not paid, and what's the, you know, some of the extremes you've had to charge the landlord?
Co-chairs and Representative Wisnant, I want to be certain we're not evicting anybody. We're abating a nuisance, so the people might remain on the property. We're just having to go perform a particular act per se. So I know semantics. Ballpark figure, it varies. I mean, if you're calling a tow truck to remove and store vehicles, I mean, that depends on what part of the state you're in, and it depends on the tow company. In my county, I would say to remove and store vehicles for, let's just say, 15 days, let's say two vehicles, you're looking at least $1,000 probably. But that's only if vehicles are the only issue. If you're having to hire a moving company to move certain items from a property, you're going to pay several hundred dollars for them to come out with their truck, two people to do that, and then you're going to pay an hourly fee. It could be $40 an hour per mover, and it just depends on how long. Plus, I mean, you have environmental issues too. Who's going to clean that up if there's oil or gas or any other substance that's contained in that property that needs to be cleaned? Majority of these cases are handled by counties and probably even the state and cities, and via their code enforcement and via their legal counsel, who file for injunctive relief and getting people to stop doing a particular act and stop, creating nuisances. This is for really those cities, counties that use this statute, and also, like I said, other citizens that may use this statute. Is something that we rarely see because it's normally handled through code enforcement, local code enforcement.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hicks, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Turning to Section 2, the new language says largely the same thing as the existing language, but there is a, I think, a critical change here made in that the expense, which had previously been charged to the defendant, the expense of the abatement is now incurred by the plaintiff. I'm reading that to mean that rather than the person who caused the nuisance having to reimburse the sheriff for paying to clean it up, it is now the person who called it in. I wonder if you could explain why that is. Is it because potentially the person who called it in is a little bit more stable than the one who caused the nuisance, and that's probably a better person to get the money from? But two, I mean, that seems a little bit wrong in a way, because now a person has been sort of victimized by their neighbor on this nuisance. They call it in to the sheriff, and now they get to pay to clean up the nuisance. Could you comment on that?
Co-chairs and Representative Hicks, I would say yes, but I would also say that, I guess it depends on what the nuisance is, and I guess it depends on the relationship between those neighbors and what that
won't
one...
Won't be good when this is...
Well,
no.
Yeah. I would say that doesn't seem right, I agree, but it also doesn't seem right that the sheriff or public safety agencies should have to incur all the costs for that. And it is recoverable, by the plaintiff who initiated that action to recover all those costs that are incurred for the sheriff in order to for the sheriff to go out and clean up the property. How they collect that, I don't know. Good luck. How do we collect it? Yeah, I don't know. Good luck. So we're just trying to shift it to match any other writ or order that we get from a plaintiff, which is to require those fees up front. But I hear what you're saying.
President Hicks, do you have any follow-up?
Well, yeah, I mean, there is going to be the issue of if Representative Schaffler and I are neighbors next to a nuisance, I mean, who's going to call the thing in? Because whoever calls it in is going to be now on the hook for cleaning it up. And two, I mean, I think there's going to be a sentiment that I pay my taxes, sheriff gets my taxes, there's a nuisance I've called in, sheriff's responsibility to clean it up. So that's, I think, a philosophical thing that, that I'm bumping up against in regards to Section 2 of the bill.
I would counter, and my colleague has a comment as well, that I too am a taxpayer, and I don't believe necessarily that I should have to pay my law enforcement to clean up junk on one's property. I don't think that that's necessarily what our job is. I mean, it's an unfunded mandate, and there could be potentially thousands of dollars that could cost a small county, for instance, in Eastern Oregon, where their budget is not that much. It could potentially cost thousands upon thousands of dollars. So,
yeah, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Co-chair. Now, I see personal property is apparently covered as something the sheriff could basically sell and try and recover in the previous bills. Would adding real property, if the sheriff was able to, through an action, seize, I suppose, title to the real property in the event that the nuisance was setting on a piece of real property owned by the defendant, would that be some kind of progress toward being able to pay the public expense of cleaning up a public nuisance?
Co-chairs and Representative Hicks, depends on who owns the property. The property might not be owned by the defendant, but theoretically the county could, I suppose, start proceedings to levy on that real property, just like the plaintiff could too, if it was shift, if this, the costs were shifted to the plaintiff who initiated the suit. So, yeah.
Representative Schaffler, do you have a question?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, it seems like this would discourage someone from reporting a nuisance. But you know, if it says here that you can recover the fees from the defendant, well, maybe they can sell his passport and his driver's license and Social Security card.
Anything further? I would suggest, Ryan, on this last issue that you think about manipulating that a little. I want you to work with Representative Hicks about a compromise. Otherwise, that bill probably won't move. Committee, do you have anything further? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2694 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2253.
And co-chairs, members of the committee, House Bill 2253 comes to us from the Secretary of State. Like the other bills, this does a few different things. First of all, it replaces the required oath for notice of filing a lien for certain non-possessory chattel liens with a self-executing attestation under penalty of perjury. What that basically means, otherwise phrased, is if you're filing a lien for non-payment of materials or services or labor, currently you need to file a verified oath. That's a notarized oath. This replaces it basically with you issue a statement under penalty of perjury, and that's considered adequate. It also makes some modification of the Secretary of State's ability and duties to certify members of the consular court. 4. This is in the intro version. And it prohibits the Secretary of State from notarizing documents of the sort that say either, I am renouncing my allegiance to the United States, I am a sovereign nation of me, and the state of Oregon has no jurisdiction over me. Just to clarify that within the law. There is a dash one amendment that has been advanced. Please let us know if you don't have it. Does a few things as well. First of all, it modifies the length of time for the filing of a lien from 75 days to 180 days. And secondly, it expands the oath requirement that it's laying out in Section 1 to cover agricultural liens, agricultural service liens, agricultural produce liens, and grain producers liens.
Okay, Peter Treckel, please.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peter Threlkill. I'm the director of the Corporation Division for the Secretary of State's office, here to talk to you about House Bill 2253. This bill comes as part of the Secretary's efforts to streamline some of our processes so that we can help serve our customers better. It's probably not going to be the most complicated bill or the most controversial one that you'll hear this session. So as amended, basically what we're trying to do is simplify the process for agricultural service liens, ag produce liens, and grain producers liens when they're filed with our office. Currently, a farmer or a farm service provider would have to file their claim with a notarized affidavit. We think that a truthful statement from that creditor should apply and be sufficient, and that's really the impetus behind this section, which is Section 1 in the original, Sections 2, 3, 4, and 5 in the amended version, where we expand that out, and that was we had, through an omission in the drafting process, we had left out a couple of our liens that we wanted to make sure were included. The next part of the bill was Section 2 in the original, and that was our first attempt at how we might solve a problem that citizens have between my office and getting documents certified from the counties or the courts. When we took the drafted bill back to the state court administrator, there were some concerns with the way that it was drafted. We agreed to work with them and the AG's office to come up with a better solution. We think that we've done that. And basically that really looks at where our current laws allow the counties, the county clerks, and the courts, their certified documents are accepted prima facie by the courts in this state and as evidence in the court. We think that that's sufficient for our process today. If you were to go and go to the get a document from the your county court, have it certified, if you needed to send that document to a foreign government, you have to come to my office. You have to have that document authenticated before the foreign government will accept it. I cannot authenticate a certified court document today unless it's notarized in the presence of a notary. And so documents that the courts process, they do them all the time, primarily for use in this country or this state. And so what we've got set up in law is a process where when that document has to go to a foreign country, it becomes a different process. The notarization gets missed all the time. I unfortunately have to instruct citizens to go back to their county and start the process all over again. It really frustrates citizens. We think it's a bad deal for everybody, and basically the Dash 1 amendment allowing us to accept what is otherwise a prima facie document and certify or authenticate to that, we think that's sufficient and would be a good solution to really help streamline this process, save our citizens a lot of time and travel and money. The last part of the bill, which is Section 3 in the original, this also deals with authenticated documents. We crafted this under the advice of the U.S. State Department, advising all Secretary of States not to authenticate or certify documents that are claiming sovereignty from state or federal laws. And so this is the fix that is proposed to make that change. So that is the gist of my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Representative Torme.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is an agricultural services lien?
Chair Krieger, Representative Torme. I grew up on a farm. My uncle raised wheat. He would often hire a company that had combines to come in and harvest that wheat for him. He hadn't been paid for the wheat yet, so he had an agreement with the combine company to basically do it on credit. Mm-hmm. So the combine company would secure their payment or for the work that they did with an agricultural services lien in my office. So it goes against the grain or the commodity, and it allows a surety for that creditor to get paid at a future date.
Follow-up? So when someone is building a house, then the people providing the roofing or the plumbing, et cetera, they also can file a lien. So why is it necessary to, in particular, point this agricultural lien out?
Chair Krieger, Representative Tomei. A construction lien exists in statute. Chapter 87 has quite a number of different lien types, from mechanics liens to loggers liens to construction liens to attorney's liens, mm-hmm. and they all sort of have their own process. Construction liens are filed at the county because they're on real property.
Okay.
The ones that are filed with my office are on movable property.
Okay.
So it's just part of what...
Limit.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Wissett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 2, are we covered under Section 2 as an elected... The second part of that says it. Elected official. Is that, are we talking us, or are we still talking about diplomats? The paragraph two, section two, paragraph one.
Chair Krieger, Representative Whitsett. In section two in the original bill, we're deleting that in the amended version. We're leaving that alone. That was the first approach, and we decided to take a different course of action after we worked with the state court administrator. So we're in the amended version, if that's adopted, we won't have any impact on public officials or consular corps officials that might register with us. So that really becomes, I think, a moot point as far as if we're able to adopt the amended version of the bill.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So the fees in 4, we're not talking about the fees that the Secretary of State increased upon us tremendously to file for election. Is that correct?
No, we're not. No change there.
Thank you.
Or impact.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Having not reviewed the amendment, is Section 3 still in the new form of the bill? Is Section 3 still a part of the bill?
Chair Krieger, Representative Hicks, yes, Section 3 of the original remains intact in the amended version.
Okay. May I follow up one?
Follow up.
So, and as to Section 3, Paragraph 2, Sub B, what is the World Service Authority? If you know,
we start down a pretty murky path when we get into the world of the Posse Comitatus and the Montana Freeman and other folks of that nature. So, I I've read a lot of the materials. It's difficult to make sense of, you know, what they think they're doing. A lot of times these are really presented as sort of a get out of jail free card, and as you can imagine, that's very popular with inmate populations. So we're just trying to help remove some of the barriers that other folks, especially in law enforcement, have to deal with.
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Anything further, committee? Okay, thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2253. I don't believe we have any more business, so we'll adjourn.
No.